Okay, my title is Long Range Propagation of Ocean Swell, and this was work that was done with my collaborator, Basile Gallet, and thanks to several people, notably Walter Monk. This is going to be a talk which is somewhat different from some of the earlier talks. It has a large historical component, and as you'll see, Monk was one of the people who was quite influential in understanding this subject. So, this picture, well, you can download many pictures like this from the web, but this in particular shows some beautiful swell and surf breaking on the northern beaches of Oahu. And notice the distinction between what I call swell, which are these beautiful long-crested waves propagating in deep water. And when they reach shallow water, two things happen. There's refraction, which means they tend to come in perpendicular to the coast. And of course, then they start to break, and this is surf. So swell turns into surf. And just to be clear about where swell comes from, these guys that you were seeing here were probably generated somewhere in the Gulf of Alaska, maybe 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 days previously, and they've been traveling across the surface of the ocean 4 or 5 days, and they eventually break on distant beaches. And there's several things about this, one of which I'd like to emphasize in particular is how weak the dissipation is. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along. And secondly, there's actually kind of a surprising, at least surprising to me, amount of energy in ocean swell. So for instance, here's a simple estimate you can make with linear theory, which is that the energy flux is the group velocity times the energy density. And then if you put particular numbers into this, so rho is the density of seawater, g is 9.8 meters per second squared, capital T is the wave period, and A is the amplitude. And then with a 10-second period and a height of 1 meter, the energy flux is 40 kilowatts per meter in a wave train like this. So to put that in perspective, this is considered by engineers who are interested in extracting power from the ocean wave field. 40 kilowatts per meter is used to identify what's called good sites, that is sites where it may be worth putting in a wave extraction device to try and get energy out of the wave field. And 40 kilowatts per meter is typical of most of the west coast of the United States, north of about Oregon, well, Northern California, and points northward, certainly most of Hawaii, not in Santa Barbara, for reasons I'll come to later, where the energy is much less. And 40 kilowatts per meter means that 25 kilometers of coastline is being irradiated by 1 gigawatt, which is equivalent to a good-sized nuclear power plant. And in the natural course of events, that would be grinding rocks into sand and sand into gravel, which is where all that, sorry, gravel, rocks into gravel and gravel into sand, which is where all that energy is going. So just to be clear, what this talk is not about is wave turbulence, okay? But rather, rather ironically, not because these waves are too nonlinear, but because they're too linear. So here's a little quote from Leonardo da Vinci, which I extracted from the preface of this book by Alex Craik. A wave is never found alone, but is mingled with as many other waves as there are uneven places in the object where the wave is produced. So that's the storm, I guess, which created the waves in the center of the Gulf of Alaska. At one and the same time, they will be moving over the greatest wave of the sea, innumerable other waves, each proceeding in different directions. So this is, I suppose, the innumerable other waves is the wave spectrum of a bunch of waves which are nonlinearly interacting with each other. But the greatest wave is what I'm talking about. That's often swell, which is a very regular phenomenon with unidirectional propagation, a clearly identifiable frequency and wave number. And swell, just to be clear, often contains most of the energy in the spectrum, rather than the innumerable small other waves which are heading in various different directions and interacting with each other. So the subject, so swell, we understand swell pretty well. And it was World War II that really provided an impetus to this research. So here's a letter from Roosevelt to Churchill in anticipation of the joint Anglo-American invasion of North Africa. Bad surf on the Atlantic beaches is a calculated risk. And the trouble was that throughout World War II, both the British and Americans were using landing craft, vehicle, and personnel, LCVPs, which tended to capsize in waves that were more than 5 feet high. And the very first time they tried to do this, they lost 64% of these boats. And that was in a landing that was unopposed by enemy action. And so this was a major impetus for wave research in World War II, as you can imagine. And most of that, of course, was really desperate applied research, trying to figure out what could be done to predict swell. And there were some fundamental things that were discovered about swell. First of all, it travels for great distances with very little dissipation, and linear theory works very well. Okay, that's what I'm saying. This is not about wave turbulence. This is really about linear wave theory. And as a result of these two facts, swell is very predictable. And the proof is that the surfers who are enjoying this swell on the north shore of Hawaii, probably 3 or 4 days before this happened, looked on the web and got a wave forecast, which is available from various websites. So this is Scripps, where I'm from, and it's very boring on this particular day. But you can anticipate swell events as much as 3 or 4 days in advance, which is a sign of its linear and predictable nature. Okay. So the first important paper on this was by Barber and Ursell in 1947. This was after the wartime results were declassified. And so what these guys realized, and what they were brave enough to try, was to take the linear solution for gravity waves created by a splash and assume that it might actually work for the ocean, where the splash is a big storm. And so suppose you're sitting at this point, and the only thing you can measure is wave frequency. You can't measure the wavelength because you're restricted to measurements at a single point. So what you see, there's a big splash or a storm, which sets out a lot of different wave packets with various frequencies and scales. Well, the long waves travel fast and reach you first. Then increasingly shorter waves with higher frequencies come in. And so what you see at a particular point is a very characteristic signal in which the wave frequency in hertz is changing linearly with time, and the constant of proportionality here involves the range, the distance between the source and the receiver. And so by making measurements at a single point and measuring the frequency, you can infer the range. And you can also see whether this theory is working, because you do expect the frequency to change linearly with time. So if you're ever asked to teach a course on linear wave theory, asking the students to derive this formula using simple concepts of group velocity is a great homework question. Okay, and it really is the most elementary aspects of group velocity. For instance, here's the deep water gravity wave dispersion relation, which applies to swell, and it implies, for instance, that the group velocity is half the phase velocity, which is one of the ingredients in this formula. So once again, Barber and Ursell, this is one of their examples. This is a weather map of the North Atlantic from March 1945. So this was in preparation for D-Day, I guess, which was in June 1945. And they had a wave observatory in Cornwall, right at the tip of Britain here. And using what they call the wave propagation diagram is the following. You plot time along one axis, the observed wave frequency along the other axis. And then according to theory, if you have measurements of the frequency, you should see a linear straight line. All the different measurements should line up on a straight line. You can measure the slope. And then the range in meters is given by that formula using MKS units. And Barber and Ursell, their conclusion was, based on measurements made in Cornwall, Linear theory is reasonably accurate, but the area of the storm is too great, and it's too close to the observer to expect really spectacular agreement. There's also a mistake in this slide. Does anyone see the mistake or an oversight? How do I read the writing? Yeah, it should travel on a great circle. And I just drew a straight line on their picture, which I copied out of Phil Tran's, I think, which is where this was published. So at great personal cost, I carefully computed the great circle. And there it is. So this is Barbara and Ursel's point that, you know, the North Atlantic is such a pathetically small ocean that this hardly counts as a test of global propagation. But nonetheless, it was very important for showing that this the simple ideas of linear theory worked spectacularly well for ocean waves. And so the next people to work on this were Monk and Snodgrass in 1957. And here is the situation. There's an island here off the coast of Mexico, a beautiful volcanic island called Guadalupe. There's another island which will feature in the history here, which is San Clemente up here. There's Santa Barbara facing south. Monk and Snodgrass put a wave observatory on Guadalupe, and they made bottom pressure measurements to test these ideas of Barbara and Ursel. And they clearly observed swell coming from the south, from the southern hemisphere. And there were very clear indications in one of their measurements of a source with a range of about 15,000 kilometers. Yeah. I should have said that we're oceanographers. We're interested in surface waves. We can't help ourselves on that respect. Why did they do it in Guadalupe? Yes. I could give you a philosophical interlude. All great men have a weakness which can be exploited to attach yourself to them. And in Walter Monk's case, if you know him, he loves islands. And this is going to be a weakness. This is a weakness of his, which will be apparent later in the talk. Okay. So using the wave propagation diagram, it's once again, you can work out the range. And it's so long in some of these cases that the storm had to be outside the Pacific. Okay. The Pacific is just not big enough to have a storm at a range of 14,800 kilometers. And in fact, if you start drawing great circles, the most plausible place for it to be was somewhere here in the Southern Ocean, south of India. Okay. So is a question? No. Okay, that's the other thing. This is a azimuthal projection centered on San Diego. So great circles which go through San Diego and are straight lines. No, they're not. They're lines of dotted things. These solid lines here are contours of equal range from San Diego. So this is, and the straight line is a great circle going through San Diego, or actually through Guadalupe, I should say. Right, so this is a great circle. The straight line is actually a great circle which goes through Guadalupe. And this arc is a line of constant range from Guadalupe. And so when I point to a point like this, it's not actually south of Australia, or south of New Zealand. It's on a great circle blocked by New Zealand, actually. This is Antarctica, yes. And we should pause to look at this because you're going to see many other pictures like this. And so you have to realize that some of your geographic intuition may be scrambled by the fact that I'm using a particular projection. Okay? it's very convenient if your observatory is centered at this point to use an azimuthal projection centered on that point. So the observed frequency shift is consistent only with very distant areas of generation in the Indian Ocean south of Western Australia. That was their conclusion. And they just couldn't leave this problem alone, Oliver. So they came back in 63 and moved to San Clemente. And so the difference here is that previously there was no directional information. You're only inferring the range. You had no idea of the direction of the incident swell, okay? So in 1963, what they did is they established a triangular array of bottom pressure sensors in a triangle off San Clemente Island. And I'm sure you can't read this, but the side of the triangle is around 900 feet. So three bottom pressure measurements are separated by about 900 feet on the side. And the idea of the triangle, it's the same as astronomical interferometry, I think. When a wave packet comes in, it will pass over one point of the triangle before the others. And by measuring the phase lag as that crest goes through the three points of the triangle, you can infer the direction, okay? And you need at least three points, because if the crest comes in like that and passes two of the sensors at the same time, you won't see a phase lag between those two sensors. So you need at least three to make this inference. So this was almost a glorious victory. They plotted their version of the wave propagation diagram, time versus frequency. Energy peaks associated with a given event appear as slanting ridges. The dispersion relation predicts that these ridges should be straight, and they are. The one problem was that the directional inferences didn't work very well. And this is why it's only almost a victory for linear theory. Some of the inferred sources were displaced. Well, some of them are on Antarctica, which is clearly impossible. Yes, you're getting ahead of me. I will come to that in glorious detail. You'll hear more about it than you ever want to know, I suspect. Some of them are on ice, which is also impossible. It's very difficult to see how you can generate substantial amounts of waves when the storm is over the ice pack. And even in clear conditions, there were sort of large displacements between where the inferred source was and where the meteorology suggested it might be. And so there was kind of a puzzle here that the swell seems not to follow great circles. So that's going to really be what the rest of the talk is about. And there's not too much original in it. So the original content is really at this point where I'm going to tell you about our attempt to check Monk and Snodgrass by using modern data. And the question is, are there really directional errors associated with great circle backtracking? So you understand what they were doing. You'd see the swell coming in from a particular direction at that triangular observatory, and then you'd draw the great circle and just follow that direction. You know how far to follow it from the range calculation. You should end up at the location of the source. So what we have is actually an array of pitch and roll buoys, which are deployed by NOAA. And they measure, these guys float in deep water. So that's the first point. Walter Monk likes being on islands. That's his weakness. That's part of the response to your question. We're making measurements in 1,890 meters of water, so it's well and truly deep water. We're not using bottom pressure. The buoy has a 3D accelerometer, so you can measure all three components of the acceleration and therefore work out the direction of the swell. And the height spectrum is measured 24 hours a day, and I believe it's not every hour. You get it's broken into 12-minute segments, and you get an inference of the spectrum in each 12-minute segment.
So it's
We, of course, did not. There's a whole network of these which are deployed by NOAA, and the data is just available on the web. So we just downloaded the data. We picked this particular one. I think there's maybe upwards of 40 off the coast of California here, mostly used for wave predictions, so you know when to go out and surf. This one was a good one because it's close to San Clemente Island, which was the original site of the experiment. Okay, so that's why we picked this particular one. Yeah, you can actually look it up. And so now it's just the same as it ever was. We plot our wave propagation diagram, time in days, the dominant frequency and the swell. This is 20 hertz, a frequency of 0.05. We can see several overlapping events occasionally when there's two swell events. And this is supposed to be a straight line. It's not bad. One thing that the classical measurements didn't prepare us for was the following thing, that when we measure the direction, we see fairly rapid fluctuations in direction, and I'll come back to those later. However, what we do is we just compute an average direction by taking the time average of these directional fluctuations. Okay, so we average the incoming swells at this peak frequency, and this is how we work out the range and direction of the storm. And here's a typical result. So here's this black circle is our inferred source of the storm. And once again, let me see. This is another one of these crazy projections, but the colored lines here are the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasting, the ECMWF, in addition to providing atmospheric data, also provides predictions of ocean swell. So this is the surface wave height in meters. That's what the color scale is. And as you can see, the inferred source falls directly on top of the ECMWF storm in the weather map here. So once again, this is this projection. This is a projection in which these lines running in this direction, they all go through the, these are great circles which all go through the buoy, 46086, so that's the direction to the buoy, and these lines are the range to the buoy. This is Antarctica with ice, tip of South America and New Zealand. And so Bazile spent a month at Scripps, and he analyzed, I think, upwards of 25 events like this. And I could show you 21 figures which look exactly like this, in which the point source apparently falls right on the maximum of the wave height field. And it's just uncanny, because if you know what goes into these models, you would never believe that this could possibly be true. Because sitting on top, I mean, the wave prediction model, which is responsible for predicting this maxima in wave height, first of all, relies on the weather map. That's one of the inputs that goes into the wave prediction model. And then the wave, the excitation of waves in the model like this is based on heavily empirical formulae, which I would never have trusted, not in a million years. And yet, somehow, there seems to be this almost uncanny consistency between the measurements from the buoy and the wave height model from the ECMWF.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some assimilated data in it, but it's, I mean, yeah. But the worst part, of, I think, the you know, we heard about weak turbulence this morning, and that's put into the wave forecast model as well. They use weak turbulence quartet interactions for surface gravity waves to work out the effect of the nonlinearity. But as I said, a main ingredient here has to be the excitation, the input of energy, which is really heavily empirical. I mean, just the worst, what you might think of as some of the most dangerous empirical modeling you'd ever see, in a way. Apparently, yes, I mean, yeah. Yeah.
assimilating satellite observations as the swell is propagating. So if they got the source a little wrong, they can fix it on route.
I don't think our inference is.
That's probably it far, but as soon as it goes away and it's cloud free, then you can then make an assimilation.
We claim we're actually catching the birth date of the storm here before they've made course corrections with the assimilation. Anyway, but still, as I said, there's like 25 storms analyzed, 21 of them look just like this, and then there are four that are wrong. So here's one that's wrong. This is about as wrong as it ever gets. There's the storm maximum, and there's the inferred source. Okay. Here's another one that's wrong, sorry. Yeah, potentially. But here's one where we know it's wrong because the inferred source lies on New Zealand. Very unlikely. On the other hand, there is a big storm just off the shore of New Zealand, so that's probably where it was. And in fact, this one is very puzzlingly wrong because if you draw the great circle from the storm to the buoy, I should be following this line to get on that great circle, then it's blocked pretty effectively by the Tuamotu Island group, which is this big group of islands about 18 degrees south of the equator, and it looks quite opaque. So it's hard to see how the swell, if you've been following the Great Circle, it's difficult to see how the swell would have got through Tuamotu.
How would you get through the rocky gaps?
Damn it.
If
I can find it. How do I say show slide here? Does it say show slide?
Okay.
I'm not sure that's going to work. Oh, okay. Well, this is the wave shadow from Tuamotu as written, as constructed by Monk and Co. back in 63. That is neglecting diffraction, yeah. Still, you would have expected it to be pretty opaque. I mean, okay, something would diffract here, but then there's a second row. That's really defense in depth against waves. Right? Well, I'm sure we could have designed a better one, but... let's see, where was I? Yeah, so I guess what we're saying is that things certainly worked a lot better than they seemed to work for Monk and Co. back in 63, but we still had some issues here, I think. So, why don't waves follow great circles? Or what might explain departures from great circle propagation of waves? The rotation of the Earth is one possibility, but there was actually an early paper also inspired by the Monk observations by Backus, 62, in which he showed that that effect was far too small. The Earth isn't a perfect sphere, but it turns out to be, when you actually quantitatively assess that, it's even less important than rotation, and rotation is already pretty small. Well, here's an interesting one, which I hope to get a chance to talk about. Surface gravity waves in some sort of theories transport mass, which is equal to the Stokes drift, if you like, of the waves, and therefore they shouldn't travel along geodesics at all. They should just turn endlessly in inertial circles because of the mass transport associated with gravity waves. This is obviously wrong. Well, it's wrong. Maybe it's not so obvious why it's wrong. Refraction by bottom topography near the three sensor array, and Walter, 50 years later, has just published a corrigendum to his paper. I'm not kidding. Pointing out this mistake and attempting to correct it. This is an important effect. The bottom topography near the three sensor array where the classical measurements were made certainly has an effect. However, our buoy is in about 2,000 meters of water, So we don't think topography near the source, sorry, near the receiver is important. And the other possibility that I am going to discuss in some detail actually is refraction by surface currents between the source and the receiver, okay? Now keep in mind when I'm talking about this, that swell is traveling at, well, let's see, a 10 second wave with a period of 10 seconds has a phase velocity of about 16 meters a second and a group velocity of 16 meters a second and a group velocity of 8 meters a second, and surface currents, well, 50 centimeters a second is a very fast surface current. So there's a factor of at least probably 20, at least 20, between the speed of surface currents and the group velocity of surface gravity waves. So I may not get time to talk about this point, so I do just want to mention the resolution to that apparent paradox, which is that on a rotating Earth, surface waves have no Lagrangian transport. The Stokes drift is exactly cancelled by an induced Eulerian mean flow, which gives you no Lagrangian transport, and this is one of those singular limits where the cancellation is perfect, even in the limit where the rotation rate goes to zero. Okay? And Baylor will talk about that if I don't. So the way we're going to assess surface currents is by solving the Ray equations, which have already appeared. So we represent, for instance, the displacement of the free surface in the iconal form, e to the is, and the phase function s. From the phase function s, you can get the frequency and the wave numbers by taking derivatives. Here is the Doppler-shifted dispersion relation, where u and v are the two components of the surface currents, and these are the Ray equations. And we're going to trace these rays, we're going to trace rays by integrating these equations through a fairly realistic surface velocity field. But before we turn to realistic models of u and v, I would just like to point out something which is either very obvious or very confusing, depending on which way you want to think about it, which is that a uniform current, in the Cartesian case, for instance, does not deflect rays from a geodesic. So that if you have a uniform velocity and I have a source and a receiver, the ray that connects the source to the receiver is a straight line despite the current which is blowing the waves sideways. Okay? So it's because the wave vector isn't tangent to the ray, there's a slight offset between the two, and you cancel the current using a small amount of the wave phase velocity, so the ray is in fact straight. So what that shows is that the speed of the surface current is irrelevant for ray bending. Okay? So just as a matter of logic, if someone suggests that it's the speed of the current which is responsible for deflections from geodesics, that can't possibly be true. Okay? No, this is exact for an arbitrary current. Oh. Yeah, provided it's traveling slower than the group velocity, or there is some constraint, but provided the waves can get from A to B, they travel on a straight line path. No, I don't think so, because if you do it in shallow water, you still have this. Yeah, or well, I guess I'm more of a mathematical jerk here. I would just observe that P and Q are constant and then, yeah.
If I keep the source frequency constant, I cannot see the shift. Just keep the source frequency
gradually crank up U until the crests are turned all the way round to be parallel to the plate grade path. So that's okay. So the U still has a component on the path. That's what happens.
Yeah, if you crank up U, I just tilt the crest more. Well, maybe if the velocity u is faster than the group speed. Yes, and here it is. No, actually, uniform u is special, of course, because it's very simple. So it's not subject to that approximation. Although maybe I should have put in a caveat. I better check it afterwards, saying provided U is less than the group speed. Because you're right, I don't understand what would happen if this was, you know, really fast, but... Yeah, but those that do, if they can make it, the ray is straight. Yes. Yes, 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 because you use more of your velocity to cancel the U. And actually, that's an interesting point. Because it's very often the case in mechanics, and we'll come to this later, that it's easier to calculate the shape of a trajectory than to figure out when and where the particle is on the trajectory. So it's easy to show that planetary orbits are ellipses. It's very difficult to calculate where the planet is on the ellipse. And that's maybe explaining an easy problem with a complicated one, but it's another example where it's easy to calculate the trajectory and more difficult to decide where things are on it. So there is a result, which I think Michael just mentioned. Actually, like so much of life, you'll find it in Landau and Lifshitz. And it is that the rays are bent, but the bending is due to vorticity. And in the limit in which the current speed is much less than the group velocity, there's this very simple and beautiful result that the curvature of the ray, that is 1 over the radius of curvature of the ray, the curvature of the ray is equal to the vorticity divided by the group velocity. Okay, simple formula. And in this subject, I'd say this is the analog of Snell's law and Fermat's principle for these type of problems, because it's a sort of simple organizing principle that lets you intuitively understand what's bending the rays. Subject to this approximation, of course. And by the way, this is true not just for surface waves. It's true for any wave which is isotropic. That is where the frequency is just a function of mod k, the magnitude of the wave number. So a good problem, maybe it's already been done, but a good problem would be to work out the three-dimensional generalization of this. I've never seen that, but is it in 3D? Oh, okay. Okay. I couldn't understand the... Okay. So you see the current with the velocity, with the current there, you might think the whole problem is anisotropic. But that's not true according to this formula. The ray curvature is independent of the direction and of the current direction. So there's no anisotropy in the problem, despite the suggestion suggested by the velocity. An irrotational velocity produces no refraction or bending. These are some of the rather surprising consequences of this formula. And it's general, and you should probably know about it if you're interested in ray tracing through velocity fields. How's my time going? Because I... Oh, okay. Okay. And I'll skip the derivation. I can't understand the solution in Landau and Lifshitz, so you can admire my solution if you don't want to. 40 minutes, really? Okay. Okay, so... Okay. Can the vorticity of realistic surface currents bend rays? And so here's what realistic surface currents look like. There's a product which is also available from NOAA, which is called OSCAR, Ocean Surface Current Analysis in Real Time. I must say, this didn't reproduce very well. So the color in all these figures is going to be vorticity. And this is the product that we're going to use to solve the ray equations. We're going to integrate them exactly. We're not going to use the Landau and Lifshitz approximation. And so here's what a typical integration looks like. You launch several rays from the source point here through the OSCAR currents. And here's one that happens to make it to an observer. And the others go other places. Once again, this is using an azimuthal projection in which a great circle that connects this source to this receiver is a straight line. And you can see this ray, which actually does connect the source and the receiver, that particular ray is very far from a straight line. Okay? So that's an indication of the bending, which has gone on by the vorticity. And in fact, you can sort of see this section here is almost a great circle. Then there's a bend. Then this is another great circle propagation. Then it hits the equatorial current system where there's more vorticity. And that bends it in just the right direction to go to the receiver. Okay? And so if you're at the receiver and you great circle backtrack, you make a very bad error, because you'd follow the great circle tangent to the intercept there, and you'd end up almost on Antarctica. And here's 20 years of OSCAR data, one frame every 5 days. We compute, we launch a whole bunch of rays from a source here, and we find the ones which go to the receiver. The red dot, which is bouncing around, is where the average is. Which doesn't coincide with the true location of the source very often. So this is integrating the ray equations millions and millions of times to get this set of data. One frame every 5 days. And so the one concept you see from here is what I'll call a multipath, which is a term borrowed from acoustics. The source is connected to the receiver, not by a single ray, but by a multipath, which is a collection of rays which pass through a fairly complicated medium, and as a result, some rays on the multipath are very far from the straight line path connecting the two. Okay. So this is the one, I think, the one new thing that I'm adding to Monk and Snodgrass. We believe that what happens is that the source here incoherently emits a whole bunch of wave packets. And some of those wave packets will reach the receiver, and they'll follow different routes, quite different routes. Well, they're emitted for many days. I mean, the storm can last for a few days. And it's... Yeah, that's right. And the time is different along each ray. You remember the directional fluctuations we observed at the receiver, where the direction would change every 12 to 20 minutes? We simply think it's different packets coming in along different rays on the multipath and arriving apparently from different directions. That's what we think we're observing, and that's what's responsible for the fluctuations at the receiver. So here's what I'm saying. Individual rays don't closely follow great circles, but the collection of rays emitted by an extended source. So instead of using a single point, we should obviously allow for the fact that real storms have a finite diameter of, you know, 1,000 kilometers or more. So they're really an extended source. The collection of all these rays, if you average over them, does provide a good unbiased estimate of where the storm is, okay? Which is exactly what we did when we analyzed the data. We averaged over the directional fluctuations. And incoherently emitted wave packets travel along different paths and arrive at the receiver from different directions. And if you really follow the envelope at the receiver, you'd think that the source was huge. You'd think that the source was much bigger than it actually is. Okay. The mirage that we saw with New Zealand is always a problem, in my opinion. Our New Zealand mirage, and New Zealanders too, I might add, our New Zealand mirage is due to the partial obstruction of the multipath, or actually in that case, by the Tuamotu Islands, which are smack on the Great Circle. So if you chop out half of the multipath by a big group of islands, then you'll only see the arrivals which come from one side, then you'll make an error. Quick comment, if you propagate these rays through the 20-year mean, they go in virtually straight lines. Okay, well, I'll just say the Landau and Lipschitz formula works very well. This is a comparison of the red curve is the simple expression for the ray curvature. The blue curve is the exact result. They're right on top of each other. So this is a plug for using vorticity thinking and this curvature formula to think about problems like this. And this is pointing out the problem with the original 63 measurements, which is that there's shallow topography near San Clemente Island, so the red here is shallow, 100 meters, and a ray like A, which is refracted at the equator and proceeds to the receiver, will in fact be cut off by shallow, the Cortez Bank, I think, in this case. And so this topography, which is offshore of the classic observatory, was sort of screwing up everything between A and B and biasing all the estimates by letting stuff through, which was only between B and C. Okay, and that's the end. Okay, thank you.
Questions? Here.
Bill, if say I consider acoustic beam, I consider wave ray crossing a jet, which is one-dimensional, then it will exit the jet with the same direction, so it's not going to be bent.
Right.
So, but your rays are bent, so does it mean you're crossing, actually, even though you're crossing the jet, you're crossing your two-dimensional structure matters?
Yes, absolutely. The 20-year mean here is much, well, actually, it doesn't look particularly jetty either. Maybe in the equatorial regions you can see, you know, vorticity of two signs with an opposite, that's the typical vorticity signature of a jet. But really, even in the mean, you don't really see strong parallel flows in the ocean. Most of the refraction is done by eddies, things which don't look at all like jets or vortices.
So I'm surprised that you say it's an unbiased estimate, because at least the strong eddy people think that eddies migrate towards the pole of their same sign. And so you would expect there to be a bias of one sign of vorticity in one hemisphere and then the other in the other hemisphere. And so you would get a biased estimate depending on which hemisphere you were shooting through.
Well, actually, most of the deflection which matters turns out to be due to the equatorial current system, which I guess has vorticity of both signs.
And fairly well balanced, yeah.
Fairly well balanced.
Because it's jet-like.
But even the asymmetry that you're talking about is fairly subtle. It's not a strong feature of ocean vorticity, I'd say. Yeah.
Any more questions?
Just a historical remark about what Bill just said. This early experiment he referred to by Monk and Snodgrass. I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Waves Across the Pacific. If you haven't, you should download it and look at it. But anyway, halfway through the movie, 50 years ago, Walter says, "Gosh, this is working out much better than we expected. I had suspected that the waves would be refracted as they crossed the equator. I was wrong." So.
They're on the movie.
God, damn it!
The movie also says something more about Walter Monk and islands.
Yes. Yeah. All of his work, you see, is wrong, because it revolved around islands where the water was shallow.
Other questions?
Just another one, because I knew some of these people. Snodgrass, the reason they were working on these things, they were not just interested in waves, they wanted to make measurements of deep ocean tides. And so they were moving toward that with this instrument. And Walter said they knew by the time they got to deep ocean tides, they had 10 years to do it, before altimeters would begin to fly. And they wanted to beat the satellites.
These are some of the people. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a photograph of Norman Barber, and both Walter Munk and Fritz Oesel said that Norman Barber was the brains of behind the operation. So it's a bit unfortunate that I don't have a picture of Norman Barber. If any of the old timers here know where I can get one, I'd be very grateful.
Okay.
Well,
Michael?
Question of information. I'm not up on the latest satellite technology, but to what extent can you actually directly see swell from satellite internet? I don't know, these scatterometers or whatever.
Oh, you can, yeah, you can definitely.
So you could cross-check all this against actual movies of actual swell on its way? Well, it says yes.
Yes, kind of, we didn't. There's been only one group I know has done that, which is in France, in Brest. And they didn't actually, it's a bit hard to tell exactly what they've done, but in principle you can see swell from satellites.
Mm. Yeah. You can see it with synthetic aperture radar, but the way they measure the wave height is with the altimeter again, because it reflects from the trough and the crest. So the bigger the spread of the reflected pulse, the higher the significant wave height.
That gives you the height, but can you actually measure the direction of propagation of the packet?
Well, you can actually see with synthetic aperture radar, you can see the individual crests because of the parasitic capillary waves on the crests Bragg scatter that radar.
Anything else? Okay, Baylor, you might as well. So let's thank Bill again.